research paper has been, like, twisted in order to get, like, this man that did horrific things let out on, like, a lesser sentence and stuff. I was just like...
That is so horrendous, too.
Like, you think the courage it took for all of those women to come forward, and, like, some of them saying, like, they've been blacklisted from certain, like, movie sets and stuff because they came forward, to then have it, like, nearly taken away like that. Mm.
But also, like, when you think about the whole Me Too movement, how much of it is, like, white influential women who are already in power who can come forward, when there's so many women that are working class, that are marginalized in different way, be it with ableism, with racism, with anything like that, and how hard it must be to come forward and actually, like, be listened to when there's so much already, like, preventing you from even being heard, and also just the economic precarity that comes with, like, challenging someone in power.
Mm. Yeah, totally. Like, the misogyny within the justice system is definitely exacerbated by the prejudice against women of color or poorer women. So it's like, if we are even looking at these statistics in a way where it's difficult for white women to even get some sort of justice in any way, like, I can't imagine what it would be like for other women out there too, who have gone through that. And yeah, it's just, it's so messed up.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere, like, in this...
so hard not to swear.
I know. I was reading in this paper that, like, with the, like, mad, bad, and sad categorization, there's, like, sort of sub-categorizations of the fact that if it's, like, the media, like, reporting on a white woman, they're often stereotyped as, like, intelligent, passive, and competent, so they'll more often be, like, placed in the, like, kind of, like, sad category or mad category with, like, justifications for their behavior. But it looked at, like, black women, and they were saying that, like, they're stereotyped as, like, dirty, hostile, superstitious, so they're instantly going to be put, like, in the bad category when there's, like, no justification towards their behavior in terms of the other categories. And it's like, I found that, like, shocking that they don't even research into, like, the case that much. If it's, like, an ethnic minority woman, they'll just instantly put them in the bad category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it might be time for a song, everyone.
You should get Rebecca to pronounce it.
Oh, gosh.
Can you pronounce it?
Aluminum? What is it?
Huh? Can you pronounce this?
Aluminum?
Oh, aluminum.
Oh. You don't say aluminium?
Well, like, it gets twisted, or like, aluminium.
Okay. Anyways, the band is Aluminum or Aluminium, depending on where you're from.
Aluminium,
and it is called Behind My Mouth. Yeah, that's all I have to say about it, but it's pretty good. So, yeah, here you go.
I go if I really let go.
seat behind my mouth.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Radio Goethe. Modern German music at its best. Every Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This is Radio Goethe.
Welcome back, everyone, to Intravenous. I am Stella.
I'm Logan.
I'm Rebecca.
And we have been talking a lot about female representation in the judicial system and justice system and just the justice system in general in regards to sexual assault cases. So just a warning, a trigger warning out there for you listening. We will be talking about sexual assault during this episode. So feel free to tune in next week if that is something you do not want to hear us talk about. I think we left off with just the discrimination within the legal system for against women, but then also against marginalized groups of women as well, and the treatment of male offenders versus female victims within sexual assault cases.
I think it would be interesting to think about the justice system in general. I was wondering a question for you both. Do you see, because we were basically, if you're just tuning in now, we were just basically saying how this whole, like, the man, like, the male perpetrator in, like, a rape case is often painted as, like, a full person with a job and a family versus this female victim who is only oriented around, like, this objectifying, sexualized person and person's, like, a bit of a stretch. And so I'm just wondering, Stella, Rebecca, if you guys think that this is, like, how we could solve this issue, kind of, or if it's about the justice system in general or this specific part of the justice system.
I think it's, like, it's a problem with the whole justice system because there's, like, different issues. I mean, I only really know the UK justice system. I don't know how it differs over here, but there's specific issues in, like, each stage that will hinder rape and sexual assault cases. Mm-hmm. And, like, I guess the, like, I don't know, like, what the word is, but the kind of, like, strength of the case when it goes to trial. So, like, for example, like, with, like, underreporting, there's, like, a huge issue with the police and, like, people, like, rape victims feeling comfortable enough to go to the police in order to report it to begin with. We had a case, I think it was, like, 3 or 4 years ago. It was called the Sarah Everard case. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Mm-mm.
Where it was a woman, she was raped and kidnapped and killed on the street by a police officer in England. And it's,
yeah,
like,
get it,
you hear that, that is instantly going to be like, well, I can't go to the police. The people that are meant to, like, protect you.
I mean, the police in themselves. Like,
yeah, the police in England in itself has so many problems in it. But, like, that representation and like that institution is instantly like one huge pitfall for like rape cases, racism cases, like
I mean anything, that entity really. Is like the police is there to reinforce this status quo and to the status quo of white supremacy, of misogyny, of ableism, and anything that deviates from that must be punished mm-hmm. and must be stopped. So I mean like the whole like institution of the police itself should be mm-hmm. in my opinion completely
it needs to be completely like stripped out and re kind of done type of thing. But like that's one problem. I mean we then like you then go to like the Crown Prosecution Service where they like assess like cases get brought to them from like the police and then they assess whether it can go to trial and if so which type of court it will go to. They are so like overrun with cases that you will like because of the backlog from the pandemic they can't obviously give the attention to detail that is needed to every single case. And if cases don't, I like there was research being done into like if cases don't look as like clear cut and black and white, they're kind of less inclined to let it go to trial if there's not a lot of like substantial evidence to it. Which is when you look at rape cases, what is classed as like substantial evidence isn't gonna be there in most cases. So they're that in itself makes it like them less inclined to allow it to go to trial. And when you know that, as a rape victim, you're going to be like, so what's the point of me?
Totally.
Come, like, speaking up on it. And then if you look at, like, actually at trial, you look at, like, juries, there's increasing research being done into English juries of, like, how bias and prejudice is, like, influencing their decisions, how we're getting more repeat jurors that are experiencing PTSD that will influence their decision making. And then you look at just like the representation of the judicial system, like the contrast of like the judges mainly all being like white old men. And you think that is the person that's running that court that is supposed to be impartial. You're not going to feel like that as a victim on the stand talking like if you're like looking at because like you'll be looking at them. Usually there's a screen. Usually there's a screen for rape victims so they don't have to look at the defendant. So they look at the jury and the judge. And it's like the lack of representation of who you're going to be facing, you might as well just be looking at your defendant.
Yeah. And there's this whole idea of like being impartial, right? And going in with no prejudice. But then it's like, so if the judge is kind of the idolization of no prejudice and no bias, but he's this old white man, it's like we already know what kind of system he's going to be subconsciously or consciously operating on. And honestly, a lot of certain prejudices can be maybe not prejudice, but just certain like previous experiences or knowledge of how the world operates for certain people is very useful to bring into the court because a lot of these things are not just in isolation where we see them in the court as they are.
It's also like you actually look in the courtroom, the judge is sat in this huge chair above everybody else as well.
Yeah.
Like it's like a physical representation of like he's like top of the hierarchy looking down on it all. Mm-hmm. And like there's increasing research as well being done into like how if there's photographic evidence used in like cases, like particularly rape and sexual assault cases, that will sway the jury instantly.
Yeah.
Like if there is a piece of like photographic evidence of anything, it will instantly sway their verdicts.
Yeah.
So it's like if you don't have that, again, you're gonna look and think, oh, like what's the point of me speaking up if I don't have any photographic evidence? It's gonna be like you guys were saying, like the he said she said, and the likelihood of like the victim getting justice is like slim.
Yeah.
And also, I'm not sure about within a lot of different countries, but I know that within the US, the whole, like, the police are said to just, their story and their, like, what they say is treated as factual because they are, you know, backed up by the state. And so if a police officer says, like, well, this is what I saw, they're not, like, it's not like a he said, she said. It's like, it is a fact, which is so insanely interesting, because like when you look at the institution of like the police force and how much it is like put into the system that you defend the police force, you defend your other like co-workers to like have this coherent force. Of course, like the police officers are not gonna talk against anyone else, and of course they're not gonna like, it's intrinsic to the justice system, this sort of like preservation, and or like how you can't deem a case, like you can't say that someone was being racist unless they admit that they were, like nominally say like, you're right, I was hiring based on race, because you can't just assume, like there's so many cases where it's like, of course the status quo is not going to be pushed against, and it's like intrinsic to the justice system that that is what the justice system is upholding, the status quo.
That is an insane amount of power to be able to frame this narrative around, basically, like, as a police officer, if that is, you're framing whatever you did as true, like, you can just basically do whatever you want with very, very little consequence. And we've seen that happen so many times with police brutality and everything. Like, all they have to say is, like, you know what, like, this Black man was being aggressive, so I had to be the one to end it, you know? Like, that kind of thing is just, it is insane how deeply, deeply corrupt the whole police system is, if we're not even challenging that or interrogating that as opposed to an individual problem, as like a structural problem too.
Yeah, because, I mean, what are the police there? They're not there to protect the citizens. They're there to protect capital.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading an article this morning that's just been released about the Met Police in England, because there was a, like, review that was put, that was, like, happened, I can't remember when, but it was really recently, in the wake of, like, the George Floyd incident. And the report, it was like very damning, and it said like, oh, the Met Police is institutionally racist. There's been like ethnic minority police officers that have now given lengthy interviews about, we feel like marginalized and the way we are treated during training, and then the punishment doesn't reflect that treatment. It's like they go and have a reflective learning course of what they should have done instead. And I don't want to say the wrong name, but it was someone high up in the police who was mentioned in the article, said that after they received that report, he disregarded the term institutionally racist. He was like, there are some racist behaviors, but I don't believe the police is institutionally racist. I think that's wrong. 25% of the Met Police is ethnic minority people. And it's like, that's a quarter. That's less than half.
And also, I mean, that's the problem with this whole idea of like representation as this sort of end all be all of like, oh, well, look at all our gender equality. Look at how many women there are in this workforce. And, like, in this workplace, for example, that does not mean that this structural racism and structural misogyny doesn't exist. Like, you can have a lot. Like, representation is important, but in no way is it the end of the line. It is, like, one of the beginning steps. But representation, like, that doesn't mean that it's like 25% less racist or anything like
that. Like, it's the way he used that statistic is like, it's not institutionally racist because we have 25% of our force as ethnic minority. And it was like, that means nothing because those ethnic minority police, like, people are still getting treated so poorly, and they're giving lengthy interviews about their treatment, and the treatment gets witnessed, and then the punishment is just a reflective learning course.
And also, like, even further than that, like, the police is an institution, like, externally, how they reinforce this white supremacist structure through, like, what was it that we were seeing? It was, like, 9 times more likely to be pulled over if you are, like, a Black man.
You're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, I mean, you can have as many ethnic minorities within the police force, but the police force is there to reinforce the white supremacist state.
It's like, especially if you look at like comparing the stop and search rates to the conviction rates when like they're actually charged with something, like the racial disparity instantly like changes. Like of, I can't remember any exact statistics, but people of BAME origin that are being like charged, the statistic of conviction is much lower than like of white. And you're thinking, so you're stopping and searching them more, but whites have a higher conviction rate. Like, that doesn't to me make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense.
I was reading this article yesterday about why does crime happen in the first place, and this article was coming from a Marxist analysis, and they were arguing that, and I agree with this, that crime is a reaction against this uneven distribution of resources. And therefore, when we talk about all these like preventative measures for crime, you know, like we're gonna decriminalize this, we're gonna criminalize this extra, we're gonna shift funding in different places, it's like these are all very much band-aid effects to a problem that exists because of this class-based structure where so few people have vast amounts of money and so many have so few and are exploited daily and need to do things in order to survive. And so, like, for me, if someone would ask, how would you solve crime? I would definitely say it would be to abolish this class system and to have a distribution of resources that is genuinely equal, where people do not have to do horrific things, or when they do horrific things that aren't tied to their economic position, it still is tied as a reaction to this, you know, system that is misogynistic, racist, ableist, and so on. That once you have a system that doesn't exist as it does now, crime will not exist as it does now. What do you guys
think? Is it talking about all crime, or is it talking about specific like economic crimes? Like, for example, with like sexual assault crimes, how does that
tie in? This was not in the article. I only read like a bit of it, but I did write a paper on how rape is like intrinsic to capitalism. And so with like crimes like that, I feel like it's definitely not as clear-cut. I think that's a really good question. So with rape, for example, that has really been used in like as a tool of colonizers to enforce these like structures of power and to enforce this kind of like property discourse, if that makes sense. Like, I was reading this thing where it's like the indigenous woman is raped to kind of reinforce this idea that they and their land are for the taking and for the taking by the white man, if that makes sense. And so within like capitalism, this whole rape of woman is within this like very this is gonna be hard to explain in like 4 minutes.
Yeah, we are running out of time right now.
But just like this kind of idea of women as object, women whose labor is so undervalued and their personhood is undervalued, and therefore it's like this kind of cyclical relationship where rape kind of reinforces this structure of women is not a person, and therefore women can be like subjected to like this forced domesticity and this forced labor, if that kind of makes sense, and like reinstitutionalize this like violence against women. I'm gonna explain it more to you after this show, but okay, I don't know if I can explain it enough in
That's fair.
Time, if that makes sense, a little.
I see how aspects of it can tie into it, but I also wonder like if rape is exclusive to capitalism or if it's.
I don't think that rape in itself is exclusive. Just to clarify, to capitalism, I think that class-based structures institutionalize it, if that makes sense. Like, when we talk about rape culture and like this whole like just rape that is, you see it widespread in so many cases, and then we look at the justice system and how rape is kind of excused and continues and it's just rampant. That, I think, is very much a part of the class structure that we live in.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, we definitely do not have enough time to get into this full discussion, even though I wish we did. Yeah, we have like 2 minutes left, so unfortunately we will have to put that conversation maybe for another time, maybe not on the radio, but for you guys to think about too. Yeah, so we're pretty much coming to an end here with our program. I'm Stella.
I'm Logan.
I'm Rebecca.
And we'd like to thank all of you for tuning into this episode of Intravenous. Do you guys have any last things to say? Nope. Yeah? You have maybe 25 seconds.
25 seconds. Okay. Yeah. I think it's just important when we look at women and we look at like this whole idea of representation and how they're painted, that we bring it back to this question of how class-based society and how capitalism necessitates this kind of representation in this painting, and how that is based on this relationship to labor.